Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello,
and welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode 115. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres.
Mystery.
Suspense.
Crime.
And thrillers. Welcome to the show. Our guest this week is Nick Edmonds, a former GP, and is now living in Stirling, up in Scotland, and is working on his second novel. His first came out last year. So we're talking to him, and he has a couple of really good little aphorisms that will help any author.
Isn't that where birds live?
That's an aviary, love.
Oh.
Do you know, I discovered one the other day I didn't know, in the centre of Stafford. Did you know there's an aviary in the middle of Stafford?
No. Oh, in the park, Victoria Park.
In Victoria Park, yeah. It's
really, no, I didn't know that.
It's really cool. I walked past it just by chance the other day when I was going to get my hair cut, and I really liked it. It's full of
birds?
Exotic birds, yeah. Yeah, it's really, and the kids love it. Anyway, I digress. We are, of course, based in Staffordshire, so not far from Stafford, about a 20-minute drive to catch a train to London, which indeed I was doing that day, which we were talking about last week. So let's get into some news. I think, first of all, actually, I want to just reflect for a moment, because the Hobeck family lost another member of his extended family this week.
Yeah, they don't get people too worried, but yeah.
No. Well, I mean, it is horrible, but Bertie is Linda Versha's beautiful Labrador.
Oh, he was lovely. He was so
lovely.
And we
got to know Bertie pretty well. We've gone to stay with Lynn on a couple of occasions, and Bertie just was so full of life and joy, and just a fantastic dog. And I'm just too lally about dogs. Never owned one, but always, you know, my spirits soar. And I had a great relationship with Bertie, as did you.
Yeah. Do you think that's the irony, though, that you've never owned a dog? I've owned dogs in my life. And yet you are by far more the dog person.
Oh, I'm nuts about dogs. In fact, it's one of the beauties of living where we are. I was just reflecting on this, that basically people walk their dogs past our barn, where we're currently living, and you know, it's like, you know, it's like a motorway full of dog walkers.
Well, actually, we're a service station. I'll tell you why, because there's a gap in the wall that surrounds our garden, and there's no gate on the gap, and dogs often see that as, oh, I can go in there then. Mm. And so when I'm mowing the lawn, almost all the dogs who go past just come slightly in to say hi. Some run right up to me for a lick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And the owners always apologise.
I went for a walk yesterday and I was licked by about four different dogs, which I totally welcome, by the way. So no problem there. But Bertie passed away earlier this week, so we're very, very sad to hear.
Yeah, we were quite shocked, weren't we, when we got the email from Lynn, because my memory of Bertie is the two times that we stayed, waking up in the morning and hearing him just outside the door and opening the door, and he would just bound on the bed and snuggle up, and it was so cute.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing that we both did was we'd play chase around a large series of bushes. It was basically ring a ring of roses, wasn't it? Each trying to outfox each other.
Yeah,
and,
but Bertie was smarter than we were.
Well, yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be hard. And quicker,
speak for
obviously.
Yourself.
And it was just great fun. So we're going to miss Bertie terribly, as indeed Lynn will, of course. So our thoughts are with her. And with Trollope the cat.
Yeah, I think Trollope is struggling, actually, from what Lynn said. The thing about animals is you can't explain to them. Suddenly, their companion has disappeared. There's nothing you can do. And they do grieve. They do grieve quite hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, it is the big downside of being a pet owner. You know, they're so important in your life, and then when they're gone, the hole is huge. Into sort of wider publishing news then.
Yes.
We ought to mark the passing of one of the publishing, UK publishing's sort of great innovators. Peter Usborne has passed away. And he, of course, as the name suggests, the creator of Usborne Books for Children, one of the biggest independent publishers of children's books in the UK.
I think anyone who is a parent or who has been a parent of small children will be very familiar with Usborne Books, because for a short period of time, they are huge in your life, aren't they? Because it's Usborne who do the "That's Not My Dinosaur, His Spikes Are Too Spiky" or whatever it is. Do you remember those?
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, they're education, mostly educational books in terms of like those tactile books for really early years. And then, you know, you go into those explaining books that I think I've got an Usborne book upstairs, which I won as it was like a progress prize, I think it was called, in my infant school.
What, when you were little?
Yeah, when I was 8, I won the progress prize, and it was an Usborne book.
Oh, wow. I didn't realise that the reach was quite that far back.
Oh, yeah. it was actually founded in 1973.
Oh, well, there you go. So they were quite new when you were little.
Yeah, absolutely. I still got it upstairs. And, you know, it's one of my
you
proudest
have to show
possessions.
Me later.
Yeah, if I can find it. But, you know, he was extraordinary, really. And he's, you know, a winner of so many awards over the years, has to be said. But, yeah, he passed away aged 85 this week. And also was involved in the creation of Private Eye, the satirical magazine.
Those two things are quite different, aren't they? So I like it when somebody dips their creativity in completely different pots.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So.
Usborne always have a very big, for the children's section, one of the biggest stands at London Book Fair.
I think they've done quite well, haven't they, as a company? Because when I was a parent, well, I still am a parent, but when my children were at primary school, they used to have Usborne book festivals. And so somebody who works for the company, sort of like a franchise basis, and they would hold a stall of discounted books in the hall for 3 afternoons after school, and they would do really well. We would always buy some books from these mini book festivals. And, you know, I presume that goes on in almost all primary schools in the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. So Peter Usborne, aged 85 and a half, as it says on their website, as if, you know.
The half is important.
As if that's important nowadays. When, you know, it is when you're 7 and a half, but not necessarily 85 and a half. You know, thoughts with his family. Your other story, it's to do with someone. I mean, let's be honest. When we set up Hoback, we were the core inspiration for the idea came from an interview I heard and we shared with Jasper Joffe of Joffe Books.
Yes.
Some years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago, I heard this. And his company, Joffe Books, just won the trade bookseller at the Nibbies.
So they're celebrating.
Yeah, celebrating that. But also they have acquired, and they're so successful, they have acquired another company.
I know. Chocolate.
Chocolate, not heard of chocolate, but I, you know, it's not a sphere that we're into, but it just shows how Joffe started off as a crime imprint, but now is into anything that will sell ebooks in popular genres.
I think it's that level of commercial fiction, isn't it, that they're interested in. So a bit like Boldwood. Boldwood have a bit of a grip on the romance side of that, but looks like Joffe are trying.
Joffe are moving in on that territory. And so they've got a backlist now from Chocolate, which is principally sort of romance and sort of cozy stories set by the seaside, that kind of stuff, you know, with the pastel shaded covers and, you know, that sort of thing that look like a Kath Kidson catalogue or something. Basically, get 250 back titles from that purchase. Chocolate themselves have been going since 2009. And so it's an undisclosed fee for the sale. Mm-mm. But it's the fifth company that Joffy have taken over.
I know. I was looking at the list and actually I hadn't quite realised how many they have.
Yeah, it's
absorbed.
It is an extraordinary success story. Jasper Joffy's company, Joffy Books, expanding all the time, not just in terms of adding new companies and authors, of course, but also staff. They've expanded in terms of that. You know, they have a new publishing director, and it started off with just Joffy himself. And you know, I think they employ something like about 15 people at their headquarters in East London. And so, you know, in the sort of trendy bit of East London, I should say. So congratulations to them. And, you know, I'm sure the chocolate authors will be in good hands.
We would love to have Jasper Joffy on the podcast, wouldn't we?
We do. We do want to get Jasper on. So, well, we just need to ask him, really, sure.
I know. We haven't even asked him, so maybe we should.
Yeah, we'll do that in the fullness of time. By the end of the year, that's our challenge. because we are actually set up with guests for many weeks to come.
I know, it's fantastic. I don't have to do much looking at the moment. It's great. I just have to remember who's the next guest.
And who is our next guest next week? Well, have you got that lined up in your mind?
Okay. No, you see, we'll
do that after the interview this week, but I'm just checking. Just checking.
And the other piece of news we had, though, is a bit more lighter, isn't it? So I wonder how many people who listen to this podcast have read The Firm by John Grisham.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that because I have read it and it was actually the first Grisham I picked up and it was a film with Tom Cruise in his early-ish sort of first 10 years of his career.
Yeah, when he was a bit foie.
Yeah, I mean, some people argue he still is, but he is remarkably well-preserved considering, you know, he's, what, 60-odd now? He's in incredible condition, given that he does all his own stunts as well, which is just amazing.
That makes me feel terribly old. Tom Cruise is in his 60s.
Shall I double check that?
Well, I suppose he must be because I'm 51.
He must be.
But anyway, so he was in The Firm and I remember watching a film. I haven't read the book. It's unusual for you to have read a book and me not to have read it. But I know it was immensely popular and the film, you know, it helped John Grisham's career even further.
Yeah, it's about a young lawyer. The original book is about a young lawyer who gets a very seductive offer from a mysterious sort of company, firm of lawyers, who have only essentially one line of business and one client. And the offer is, you know, hugely seductive. You get a car, house, very high salary compared to, you know, anyone else leaving law school. But what, of course, I don't want to give spoilers away, but, you know, let's put it this way. A single client ain't all it's made up to be.
No, yes, there's always...
And then, you know, a conspiracy continues and this young lawyer has to face incredible dangers to expose it.
It's a great film and a great book, I imagine. Mm. But the news we're talking about, we're not just talking about that for fun.
And Tom Cruise is exactly 60.
So he's still within my limit. Anyway, so we're talking about the fact that John Grisham is going to be publishing the follow-up to The Firm.
Yeah, and have we got a title for it?
The follow-up is called The Exchange, and it's I think it's Hodder that are publishing it. So that is actually quite exciting, I think, because I think it'll do really well. Because it's one of those books, it is the book that sort of really launched the legal thriller genre.
It did, yeah. I mean, John Grisham has sold multi millions of books ever since. Right, so yeah, so it features Mitch, the main character from The Firm.
Yes.
And here's the very brief blurb. So you said Hodder publishing it?
I think so.
I think it's Penguin Random House according to this, but anyway, maybe that's in the States. I don't know. Anyway, let's have a look. What became of Mitch and Abby McDear? Well, what indeed? After they exposed the crimes of Memphis law firm Bendini, Lambert & Locke and fled the country. And the answer is in The Exchange, the riveting sequel to The Firm, the blockbuster thriller that launched the career of America's favourite storyteller, James Patterson, now rolling his eyes. It is now 15 years later and Mitch and Abby are living in Manhattan, where Mitch is a partner in the largest law firm in the world. And when a mentor in Rome asks him for a favour, that will take him far from home, Mitch finds himself at the centre of a sinister plot that has worldwide implications and once again endangers his colleagues, friends and family.
Just to clarify, it is indeed Hodder, at least in the UK. Hodder to publish landmark follow-up.
Okay. Well, that's terrific. I mean, you know, that will sell gazillions of books.
It will do. It will, because the people who read it the first time are now of an age, they're the people, well, our demographic of readers, I think, at Hoback, the ones who read a lot and love thrillers.
But I think this is an interesting move for John Grisham, because he tends not to go over the same territory. You know, he comes up with a new scenario, new characters. So to go back to something, you know, the origin story, really, of his career is quite a challenge. Now, that might suggest, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's been motivated by the fact that sales are a little slower than they used to be, because, you know, that could be a fact. I don't know. It could be just that scratching that itch.
I wonder if it's that. If he just, you know, had a period of reflection and thought, you know what, I'd like to revisit that.
Yeah, okay. Well, when's it out? Do we know?
It doesn't have a date yet, so.
Ah, okay, right, well. So we'll wait with bated breath for that.
Oh, I stand corrected. October.
October.
It would be October,
oh, well,
wouldn't it?
Of course it would be. It would be a Super Thursday book, no doubt. Wonderful. Right, let's get to our interview with Nick Edmonds, otherwise known as N.J. Edmonds. That's his...
That's his writing name.
His nom de plume writing, yeah. And his debut novel, Miles Away, was published last year to considerable acclaim. And it is a historical crime novel in the sense that it's set in areas such as Fife and Aberdeen in the 1970s.
Which is now historical.
Well, it is. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're talking getting on for 50 years. So, yeah, it does count as historical, even though it's within living memory of you and I.
We are now historical.
We are. We are. Feel it. So we spoke to him from his home in Stirling. Here's Nick Edmonds.
What a great pleasure it is to be joined by Nick Edmonds. Thank you so much for joining us on the Hopcast Book Show.
It's a pleasure to do something like this. I haven't done anything like this ever before. I think I'd listened to about 3 podcasts of any sort before I volunteered for this a few months ago, and I've now listened to a few of yours, so I know what they are. Before that, I didn't really have much clue, so I'm up for anything, but please forgive me.
The first of many, I hope, as an author, because as an author, you know, you might get invited onto more podcasts. So,
well,
hope you don't put you off.
I'd never considered that anything like this would ever happen. I sat down to start writing a book. I sat down to see if I could find a hobby when I retired. And a few years later, the book was published, and it was all a bit of a surprise to me. But I'm delighted and very lucky.
It's interesting because, I mean, you're saying that you hadn't really considered the podcast, but you have put yourself out there in the sense that what we were saying before we started recording at Bloody Scotland, you had one of the spotlight opportunities where you get to speak on stage.
I've done that, yes. And
that's quite something, because that's, you know, those, that hall is big.
Yeah.
The audience is decent.
They light it quite well, though, in that there's a spotlight on the spotlighter, as they call them. The rest of the place is black. You can hardly see the audience at all. It's almost like you're speaking, it's almost as personal as this. You're really speaking to the people on the stage beside you. And I didn't actually feel as threatened as I would, as I thought I would. I mean, but through my career, I've had lots and lots of times, well, 100 times a day, before you say, next patient, you mentally think, back on stage again. Because you're kind of on stage, you're being yourself, but you're presenting what's expected of you, and you may be thinking about 2 other patients at the same time, but you can't show that when you're in there. So I'm used to thinking on my feet and being dropped in it, but I don't always volunteer for it. But no, Bloody Scotland is a great opportunity, and I'm sure this is as well.
Oh, we'll hope so. Now, that's interesting. So let's just put people in the picture then. Now retired, and you've written this book during retirement, as you say, looking for a hobby. But before that, you were a GP. So you never know what's coming through the door on each of those appointments, do you?
Absolutely not. You might know the patient. You might have known the patient for 20 years.
Mm.
And then they come in with something gobsmacking or something mundane or something you've never seen before or something you've seen three times already that morning. But that's what I loved about it. I really loved about it. I didn't want to be a specialist in anything and end up just looking at somebody's little fingernail for the whole career or a dentist. Can you imagine just looking at people's mouths all day? At least I got to look in other places and orifices and things. But
it's funny you say that about dentists, because I took my middle son to the orthodontist the other day and his orthodontist is so chatty. And I think it's because he's bored of looking at teeth all the day. He was telling me about his teenage posters. He once told me about all the nightclubs he used to go to. Because because he's doing the same thing all the time.
Of course, you had your son with you. You didn't have your mouth full of instruments.
No.
That's the annoying thing.
He couldn't respond. Exactly. His mouth was locked open.
Yeah. I once phoned my wife at about 8:45 in the morning. No, I texted her. That's what I did. I used to start surgery about 8:05 in the morning. And I remember texting her and saying, probably with a swear word in it, but along the lines of, it's 8:45 and I've already had my finger up three arses. As a male GP, you did quite a lot of that sort of thing. As I got older and older men gravitated towards me, I knew a lot of prostates on very, very first name terms, you know. So,
brilliant.
But at the same time, every one of them was different. You know, they're all people, and they're all challenging. So.
Yeah, they all have their own stories, don't they, in their own ways. But now you're retired, though. Do you get people still come up to you and say, "I've got this weird spot on my face"?
Occasionally. It's more often the other way around. I'll spot somebody in a supermarket and think, "Oh, who is she? Oh, Mrs. So and so, how?" And they go, "Who are you?" They can't remember who I am. And I go, "Oh, sorry, I bothered you." But that used to happen a lot and I think contrary to, well, I didn't. It never bothered me. It never bothered me when a plumber said, dropped his trousers and said, "What do you think of that?" And I'm going, "Well, let's have a look." You know, it didn't really bother me because it was interesting. I enjoyed my job. But
No, that's good.
And the benefit for a writer in your position, I mean, seeing so many people, and a lot of it obviously connected to mental health as opposed to arses or indeed any other physical elements. You know, that insight is so invaluable, isn't it? Because I think for an author to have, you know, that experience of dealing with so many people from different, that must have fed into your work.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't have to think very long to think up an interesting facet of some character's personality, or something surprising, or something shocking. I don't have to think for very long to come up with something that nobody else would believe. There are some very sad and tragic stories that I could never repeat to anybody for confidentiality reasons, but you would just never believe them if you could. And in a way, that's when I started writing, I enjoyed that freedom to, instead of every single thing I wrote for my whole career, whether it was patient records or letters to consultants or reports on this or that, I had to basically be willing to, sometime in the future, I might be called to stand in court and justify what I'd written. So it had to be the absolute truth. Now, that's an extreme example, and it only happened to be a couple of times in the whole career, but you had to think about that every time you wrote something. But the freedom to make shit up, to just invent stuff and tell absolute lies on the paper I really enjoy that, making things, inventing things based on what I try and do is write things based on real things that may have happened or I've heard about, but I can make them up And I think, as you say, Adrian, the number of different people and personalities that I've had to engage with, no matter how much you love them or hate them or are shocked by them, you have to engage with them. I've learned an awful lot about a lot of different types of people, and I try and use that whenever I write about a character.
How about in terms of dialogue? Has that been a benefit? Because it's something that I've always taken great pleasure in, listening to the way that people speak. I mean, it's different when you write it down. You have to sort of slightly alter it. You can't necessarily phonetically word.
No, because you'd have lots of ums and ahs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a kind of an artificial construct, but nonetheless, capturing the spirit of someone in dialogue, is that something that you've picked up as a result of speaking to so many people?
I hope so, yes. And I've spent my whole career working in Scotland, but in various areas of Scotland. So I've learned quite a lot of different vernacular from different areas where they use completely different words in Aberdeen than they do in Stirling for everything. But lots of medical terms that your granny would say. I don't know what your granny would have said when you were your nose was running and your eyes were streaming and you were full of the cold, might have been something we said in some places, smorn with a cold in another place.
Yeah.
All sorts of different expressions. So I do try I can say books now because I've written I've only had one published, but I've written more. But I do try and if my character's in Aberdeen or in somewhere deepest rural Fife, which a lot of my first books took place in, I do try and use the language that they used there. And I enjoy that aspect of it. I like dialogue,
You know, you're talking about the reflecting on the different regional differences in the way people speak. But another challenge that you set yourself with your most recent published book with Miles Away was to set it in a historical context, 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that in itself is another challenge of trying to get those details right. How much work went into that element?
I've thought about this. When I decided I was going to write a longer thing than the short story that it started out as, because it did start out as a short story, the one thing I'd learned or read about, I'd never had any formal training in writing, and I still have almost zero form. I have, let's be honest, I have no formal training in writing. But one thing I had read was write what you know, and I thought, well, that's a shortcut then. So when I started about locations, the story is based in locations that I knew very well, and it's also based in locations at times that I knew very well. I mean, I lived through the 1970s, and the book is basically it covers the childhood of the main character as well, who grew up in Fife. That's me. It's not me, but I grew up in Fife.
Yeah.
He eventually goes to Aberdeen University. I went to Aberdeen University. I promise you, I'm not the character. I don't know if you've read the book, but I won't spoil it. But I'm not going to tell you what he does because I didn't do that.
But you can pull from those experiences, can't you?
Yeah, and as you say, making things accurate about what went on then was quite easy for me because I can remember, what was I doing in 1977 in Aberdeen? What was on the jukebox? And I can pluck that.
Good. That's a good skill.
A wee check for veracity, though, because one of those was picked up by an editor, said, oh, you can't say, no, Blue Oyster Cult, in 1977, because it wasn't released till March 78. Oh, thank you. So I had to change the norm. But I was a year out, but I let myself off. But yeah, but that kind of thing, and people have commented, oh, I remember what it was like not to be able to use a mobile phone.
Mm.
And not to have a phone to, you couldn't, I mean, I used to phone my mother once a week, if I remembered, from a phone box. Mm-hmm. And if she was wittering on too much, I would knock on the glass. Oh, somebody else is wanting the phone, Mum, I better. Yeah. But I try to put that kind of thing in as well. But it's not all computer. It wasn't all computers and mobile phones and everything.
No, indeed.
Well, there wasn't hardly anything like that, was there?
Research was libraries and old newspapers and
things like big that. Encyclopedias, if you were lucky.
Yeah. So I try and reflect that, and I think it's important to do that. But I didn't find that difficult because I can still remember. I was surprised when somebody described my book as historical fiction.
I'm afraid so.
I'm sorry. I'm not history yet, am I? But I enjoy that aspect of it, the different setting. But yeah. When that didn't work, it took me a long time to get Miles Away published. Well, I didn't really try very hard, but I was lucky. I was lucky. But after a couple of years, or a year or so after I'd finished what I thought was that's as good as I'm going to get it, I thought, well, I'm just going to write something else. And that didn't work. So I actually wrote another book set in the near future.
Oh, okay. That's completely different then, because
I'm not any good at that. So I'll try something else. So I've got another book that I have completed, and I think it's as good as I can get it. Although I keep editing it, and I'm still hopeful that I might get that picked up one day. But it's a completely different story. It's near future geopolitics, and it's a thriller. It's exciting. There's all sorts of intrigue and bigamy and all sorts of things happening, and it's set in a part of the world that I've never visited before. It's set in southern USA and Florida and Cuba, in the near future. That was a completely different tangent to go off on, because I thought Miles Away, well, that's just going to gather dust somewhere.
how difficult was that process then? If you've not visited those locations, you know, you're not relying on that sense of place.
That's the contrast between writing that historical fiction when there's no mobile phones and no internet. Google Maps is wonderful for looking at things. And Google itself and Google Images, for if you want to look up Downtown Havana Cafe 1970, you'll probably find some pictures that give you something to base your description on in Google Images somewhere. So I shamelessly used a lot of that kind of thing for locations and inspiration and words as well. What street food do Cubans eat? And
I wouldn't have a clue.
I do now because I looked it up, but I can't remember because it's in one of the chapters somewhere. But it's great. I enjoy that. You can put in those little details, which I kid myself that somebody who's actually been to Cuba might think, oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. But the start of that book was based in Louisiana, which I do feel like I know. I've never been there, but I feel like I know it because an old friend of mine, well, a patient of mine actually, came in and gave me a book one time, and it was by James Lee Burke. I don't know if you know the American crime writer. And I've read 20 or more of his Dave Robichaux series books, and they're all set in New Orleans and the surrounding area, and I feel like I know that place. I feel like I've been there. His descriptions, his oh, you can smell Louisiana when you read his books. It's lovely. It's lovely. But so I started it there. I suppose that's write what you know, or write what you know vicariously anyway. But,
what's your creative process like then? I mean, in terms of you've obviously teeming with ideas, at what stage do you commit to it and then start building your stories?
Miles Away came from simply, I'd quite like to write something. What will I try? Well, what have I done before? And the only thing I could remember doing was a short story that I wrote in my school exam when I was 17. I had 20 minutes left at the end of the exam question to write what they called a composition. And you weren't given any topic, but it had to be a story with a beginning and a middle and an end. And somewhere, out of absolutely nowhere, a story, I don't know why I thought about hypnosis at that time, but 20 minutes later, I had a story about a man who'd, I didn't even know anything about hypnosis. I didn't even know what hypnosis was, but a man who'd had an overdose of hypnosis, which is impossible, but and as a result of that, he'd caused horrendous mayhem and trauma. And well, I passed the exam, so I thought, well, that worked. So I thought, well, I'll revisit that story. And I was literally going to write a short story because I was a hypnotherapist for a while.
Oh, that's interesting. My mum was a hypnotherapist as well for a while.
I was a member of the British Society of Medical and Dental Hypnotherapists or something. And they were a very closed organisation that would only take on their courses qualified doctors or dentists.
Because she used it in a medical capacity as well, because she was a Macmillan nurse.
Oh, yeah.
She used it as a palliative.
Yeah. Oh, superb, superb. Yes, absolutely. But it was, they were very keen to separate from any notion that it was anything like magic or these stage hypnotists, the famous ones that
make Darren Brown and all those sort of things.
Yeah.
Cora and all that.
I think it's an apple and all that. That's abuse. I mean, that is abuse.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. No, she said the same thing. She'd get very cross if people thought it was the same skills and the same.
And I went to that's another parallel with Miles Away, actually. When I was a student, I went to a stage hypnotist in Aberdeen and laughed my socks off and thought it was absolutely fantastic. But actually, along from me, there was a man who kept having to stand up and laugh or drop his trousers or something in the audience every time the man gave him the trigger word. And he looked along the line and said, I hate this while this was happening. You know, he was doing it, but he hated it. And I thought, well, I thought he was playing along or something, but he was clearly
in distress, yeah.
In distress, but still having to go through this process that I would now class as abuser had done from the stage to him. So anyway, sorry. I used hypnosis and I thought when I came to write Miles Away, I could base this short story as it was going to be about what really can go wrong with hypnosis or what hypnosis might really uncover and base that on a story. And that's a big theme through the book. I got that story and it just went on and on and on. And I realised I had the beginnings of what would be a full length book. Mm. And that was when I first decided I'm going to write a book. I didn't set out to write a book. And it ended up with, I think it was 110,000 words or something in the end, which is quite a long, short story.
Yes. That's more than a short story.
I now, the second book, I had an idea the second book, I had the idea was basically, what if? And it was around about the time when they stormed the Capitol. And, and the answer to what if, or the rest of what if, was what if they'd actually taken over and there'd been a revolution. And the book, basically, it's set a few years after that, but after what has happened as a result of them storming the Capitol and how America has changed out of all recognition. So that was the basis for the idea of the story. And then I managed to get some peril for my main character, and he ends up being a bigamist, and accidentally, by the way, and there's an exciting gunfight at the end, and there's all sorts of
that's an interesting conundrum. An accidental bigamist. I'm how does that happen?
yeah well, one day you might be able to read the book.
Absolutely. No, that's a fascinating scenario. No, I mean that's interesting. You take it. I mean, that is a I mean, we were presented with that what if as a as people, and there's various what ifs going on in the world at the moment. What if Putin were to fall?
Yeah.
What's the alternative? And if you read enough around it, it's not looking good, because actually even more deranged and nasty people are most likely to be taking over in that context.
Isn't history all about what ifs that don't actually happen?
Well, in a sense, yeah. I mean, you know, the speculative history, I love that stuff. I mean, I will happily read any book that speculates as to, you know, if Hitler had gone and taken the oil in the Caucasus, he'd have won World War II, that kind of stuff. It's fascinating.
You might like this, because it takes it to, within a few years, I'm not going to, nobody's ever going to read this book, so I'm not going to, there's no spoilers in this. The Cuba, the remaining superpowers, which doesn't include America by that time, or the UK, by the way, the remaining superpowers have chosen Cuba as the world center for all financial activity. So everything is channeled through, you know, through a big fancy place that I call the Bourse Cubaine, and everything is channeled through there. And Cuba is by no means a power, but it's been chosen as a neutral territory by the Chinese and the Europeans and the Indians, who are making all the decisions for the world by that time. but that's a backstory to the story. Obviously, there's a story about people, and getting into great peril, and some nasty villains who might be recognisable. Some of the villains are based on real people. One of them is so real that I name him in the book, because he's. Everybody thinks he's dead, but in my book, he's still alive, and he's a bastard. but again, I told you when I started writing, I just wanted to make stuff up, and I'm enjoying it.
That is always a great pleasure, isn't it? And do you hit roadblocks when you're making stuff up? Do you get to points where, you know, you're double checking that, you know, you haven't got enough peril or some element's not working? What catches you out?
I more often for me it's I know where the characters are at the moment, and I know where they're going to go. And how the hell do I engineer that into the story? How do I get them back from that island to that island? And also, how does his first wife that he thinks dead, how does she turn up? So I have to engineer that story, and that kind of thing's a definite road. But that's the lie awake at night thinking, where can I how do I get from there to there? But I thoroughly enjoy it. I love it. I love making it up.
It is that puzzle, isn't it? I mean, this is an area where I struggle in a way that I always feel like I've got to describe how they get from one scenario to the next. And actually, the very best books in that sort of sphere of thrillers or whatever, they sometimes make a feature of the journey, but often they don't. And it's sort of, you know, suddenly you're there and you just take it for granted. And actually you can, you know, in a film sense, you wouldn't necessarily show the entire nuts and bolts of.
Especially if they're on a plane for 9 hours, you wouldn't want to describe every peanut they eat.
Yeah. You blocked the toilet on the plate. Sorry, I haven't bring that up. No. absolutely. But you do have to have a way of the reader saying, how come he's turned up there now? You have to explain it somehow, but you don't have, you know, he arrived via so-and-so and, you know, mentions in conversation that he changed planes at so-and-so or something. You have to, and then the time, you have to make it believable that they've jumped from there to there. Another piece of good advice I learn by listening to little things that I think make real sense to me, and Write What You Know was an obvious one.
Yes.
But the man who, my dog's trying to come into the room now.
We like dogs.
The publisher who eventually took on Miles Away was on the phone once, and he said, think of it this way, and this is probably bread and butter to you, but he said, always arrive late and leave early. So
it's life.
Yeah, but he said, if you've got a passage about something that happens at a dinner party, you don't want to hear how they got there and they got in the car and it was raining and they got out and they rang the doorbell and so-and-so met them. You open it with them in conversation at the dinner party. And you make it obvious that they're at a dinner party. And then they're in conversation and whatever happens that you want this to take your story forward happens. And then that scene can end. And the next scene, you're somewhere else. But there's got to be a link somewhere, but you don't have to explain how they.
It's a very good piece of advice, and actually, you know, funnily enough, we haven't heard. So I think that's
similar.
That's
really stuck a chord with me, because it meant you can move from one passage or one chapter to another, and immediately the reader knows, oh, we've gone here now, because they haven't had to read all that stuff, but you've moved the story on, and I took that on board. And it's little things like that I'm lucky. I remember an old professor when I was a student, medical student, leading a group of us at the end of a bed. He wanted 15 causes of atrial fibrillation, which is a heart problem thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
a super chap, McLeod, and he stood in his white coat. And we got about eight of them. And then he was giving us clues all the time. He was playing with us, basically, and giving us clues. And then when he got us there, he said, and what am I doing now? And he mimed throwing things like that. And then he said, I'm just scattering pearls of wisdom.
Oh, love it. Yeah.
And that's always stuck with me. And I remember all the causes of atrial fibrillation because that really meant something to me.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, that's a little bit more a positive approach than the Lancelot Spratt version from the Doctor in the House, you know, kind of series.
There are teachers and there are not teachers, aren't there?
Yeah. And I think that sounds rather like the sort of thing my dad would do. In his, in the past when he was teaching pathology at Cambridge University, sort of he loves that. He's still a specimen now for Manchester University.
Yeah, he keeps going off to be a specimen, doesn't he?
Yeah, because he's got a very rare condition called yellow nail syndrome, so he sits there, spends a whole day being poked and prodded, and they've got to figure it out. Yes,
they have to guess what he's got.
Mm, he loves it.
Yeah. Don't take me back to those days, because I learned all those rare things. Well, not all of them. I can't even remember what you called that syndrome there, and I've probably never heard of it. And that's because in 35 years as a GP, I was never going to encounter one of those really, really, really rare things. And yet we had to spend hours and hours learning this about these really, really rare things.
Off chance, yeah, that plumber drops his trousers and says...
It is on the off chance, because it's 1 in 6 million people get this. So, took years to diagnose
him. He said, don't look at my fingernails. So, of course, I did look at his fingernails.
Yeah, it's not another pretty sight. Right, we've got to that point where we need to get to the random question.
Oh, okay.
If you don't mind. And it's been really fantastic speaking to you, Nick. And really, and those last two
pearls of wisdom. Given us, yeah.
You know, you see, this is the beauty of this podcast, is that you just, whenever you speak to somebody,
there's always something new.
They may well start thinking, oh, well, I've got nothing to offer this. You know, they had, you know, Kate Moss on, or, you know, Ian Rankin or whatever. It doesn't matter, because there's always glints of gold in there. And I think that's part of what we're trying to achieve here, is by speaking to anybody who's gone through the process of writing a book, you get something, definitely. Yeah. And it's worth doing. So
I've enjoyed it.
To match the dog.
I've enjoyed it immensely so far, but I'm not sure I'm going to enjoy the next bit.
No, I dare say this could be one of those moments at sort of 5 past 8 where you know, it's going to feel like you're having...
be texting your wife saying,
I'll say no more. Anyway, I'll do the voice. Rebecca's random question.
If I gave you the magic power to speak any language instantly from now, what language would you pick and why?
That's a good question.
Klingon. No.
That's really weird. I thought a pace says Klingon.
No, I was going to ask, am I allowed to ask a question? But it was going to be, is it a real language or a fantasy language?
Anything goes. So yeah, Klingon does qualify.
I'd probably like to speak dog in that case.
Ah, good one. Good,
yeah, because you've got a Cocker Spaniel, is it?
Cocker Spaniel, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a particular type of language.
On the background. How did you know that?
We do our research here.
It's
in your Author Central biog on Amazon.
Amazon.
Well, next question. What's his name?
I don't know that.
Oh, and if it's not the same as what's on the back of that, it says he lives in the shadow of the Wallace Monument with his wife and Cocker Spaniel, Ozzy.
Ozzy!
Well, Aki has joined us. She's purring away at our feet.
The cat is actually upside down on my foot, but that's normal.
Right. That's a really good one.
You have to answer it too now.
Right. You speak a bit of this, so I'd like to speak Japanese, if I'm honest.
That would spoil it, because you can't talk without him understanding what you're saying. You can't.
Well, there is. You know, it's interesting because you've mentioned that, and I had quite a few Welsh colleagues when I was at the BBC at one period, and they just they did the Klingon thing of speaking, you know, fluent Welsh to each other, and I mean, you knew that they were slagging the rest of us off, or at least that's what we all suspected. Yeah. It sounds like it. I mean, you know, I mean, Welsh is pretty close to Klingon, some would argue. Indeed, Dutch is very similar to Klingon, I think. But Japanese for me, because when I was a tour guide, I just desperately wanted to be able to communicate with all the sort of at that stage of my life and in sort of the period of history of tourism. We're talking about late 80s through to the mid 90s. Most of the non-European or American guests were Japanese to Cambridge, and now it's Chinese. But I would love to have spoken and to be able to bring some of those stories to them in their own language. And I could say konnichiwa, and that was about it.
And they love it as well. If you don't let on that you speak Japanese and you're encountering someone from Japan, and then you suddenly, they love it. They think it's brilliant because they didn't expect it.
How about you? What's yours?
I think I'm going to go for Russian because I'd love to be a spy. And I could be a Russian spy.
You think so?
Yeah, because as a spy, wouldn't I?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, really inobtrusive. You know, you don't just sort of give voice to everything that you're thinking. You know.
That's a woman thing, isn't it?
Because I'm so rubbish. They wouldn't suspect me as a spy.
True.
I actually tried to convince my children I was really a spy, and they just, no, you're not.
I nearly said something sexist. Well, I did say something sexist. I said, that's a woman thing, isn't it? Where they between their tongue and their first thought. It goes straight out their mouth, doesn't it?
Sometimes. Oh, it does all the time.
Well, with me too, I'm afraid. You know, I'm in touch with that side of me. It's funny because we traveled to the Soviet Union in the 80s, and I think I've mentioned this on the podcast, and my sister was learning Russian. So that was both a blessing and a curse.
What, your sister learning Russian?
She was quite good. She was doing O-level Russian. And but it meant we got into all sorts of weird conversations.
She attracted strange men, didn't she?
Well, she did, yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. She was only 15 at the time.
Talking about spying, I've just been in Berlin and I'm really spied out at the moment because there's lots and lots of museums all about the Stasi and about all that Checkpoint Charlie stuff. Oh, that's fantastic. Actually, I really enjoyed it there. It was great.
I love Berlin. Yeah, I did an art trip there. So I did an art degree as an adult and we went to Berlin and there's a lot of art in Berlin.
No, sure. And a lot of great music's come from Berlin, and you think about Bowie's period there on YouTube and whatever. Yeah. Anyway, we'll draw things to a close. So, Nick, tell us where we can find you in terms of, you know, the book and you online, all that sort of thing.
I have a little, call it a website, www.njedmunds.eu. I am on Twitter at NJEWrites. The book Miles Away, which is a great read, by the way, it's on sale through Bear. Well, it's on sale through Amazon and all the usual places, but the publisher is Bear Press, all one word, .uk.
Brilliant.
Bear is in the animal rather than the what you get to have a examination. Right. Yes. Okay. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you, and we'll catch up with you, no doubt, in Stirling for Bloody Scotland a little later in the year.
I'm definitely going. I don't think I'll be on the stage or anything this time, but I'm definitely going, and I really hope we meet up. Yeah. Definitely.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time.
Nice to meet you both. I'll keep listening to the podcast. By the way, Hobcast, do you know that predictive text? It comes out of Bobcats.
Does it? Yeah. Well, maybe we should change it to that. We might get the Bobcat lovers of the world listening to us.
What is a Bobcat?
We'll take that offline.
Oh, is it rude?
No.
No. I think it's some American little.
It is.
Thing or something, isn't it? Or something. Who knows? That lesson for today. Really nice to speak to you both. Thank you.
Our thanks to Nick Edmunds for joining us. And again, we apologise for the confusion, which led him to be put under some pressure a fortnight ago.
Where
our guest, and we got up on the Zoom link and waited. And of course, we were 2 weeks early. Never mind.
Yes, we have spent quite a few times like that now, haven't we? Sat staring at your laptop.
Yeah, we have. And
it's usually my fault.
Well, sometimes. But anyway, let's just think ahead to next week. Who have we got?
So next week, we have a guest who we've met very briefly once before, and I'm quite excited about this guest. This is Louise Mangos.
Oh, yeah.
Who is a crime writer, and she's actually a friend of one of our authors. I think she lives quite close by, or they meet up every now and then in Switzerland.
Oh.
So Linda Huber.
Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. And as you say, she is a prolific author of psychological
and
thrillers.
I believe she also knows some of our other authors, the ones who did the UEA master's qualification. So there's sort of links. There's quite a few links between us and Louise, but we haven't had a proper conversation with her yet, which we're going to do this week.
Excellent. Right. Well, we'll look forward to speaking to Louise next week. Well, what's in store for us the next week? Well, Easter, of course. And we do have the kids back. Your eldest is back from Leeds University. barely making an appearance. He seems to be sleeping the whole time.
Well, the thing is, he was up early this morning.
Yeah, he's watching the Grand Prix.
In fact,
Australia.
He heard you go to bed the second time.
I'm not surprised. I left the Grand Prix playing on the TV just in case he wanted to come down and watch it.
I got very confused because he said he'd watched it downstairs and I thought...
Yeah, no, I left it playing. I ought to confess that I stayed up for a large chunk of last night to watch the first night of WrestleMania from Los Angeles, WWE. It is one of my secret sort of passions, I have to say, watching the wrestling.
That secret.
Well, no, my younger son, James, he just loves wrestling. And so it's one of our key sort of points of contact, really. To be honest, we talk about it every day. So I have to keep... I almost feel like I'm doing revision every time because I want to watch the shows to sum across what's going on because it's such an important point of contact and conversation for us both. So, I'm feeling a bit bleary and there's another night of it tonight. So,
Not going to do the same again, are you?
I'm not sure. I don't think I could survive.
Don't forget the day job.
Yeah. Well, in that sense, I've got one more Roman Legionary book to do and less than 2 weeks to do it in. So,
and we also have the podcast tomorrow and a meeting with one of our authors. So you need to be bright and...
Yeah. So I'm going to stay up. I'm going to stay up tonight and watch WrestleMania come what may. So I'm really behind the curve on everything. So the kids are knocking about and then we've got a week without them. But we can talk about that next week, what we might do with that time. We've got so much to catch up on. And in a sense, you know, it's you and I have been working very, very hard on our freelance side of things, that it's actually quite nice to think that is going to ebb at some point and we can actually spend some time thinking about the next 8 months.
Is it going to ebb?
Well, not necessarily for you, but I'm not going to be narrating for much longer.
No.
To that level of intensity.
Yeah, so we've been trying to get through our submissions pile, haven't we?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we've dipped into it. And I would say 1 in 5 so far have been strong enough for us to look at the full manuscripts.
Yes, and I've just finished one of the full manuscripts and emailed the author in question. And I'm reading the second full manuscript starting today. So, yes, we are getting there.
Absolutely. Well... we've also got some decisions to make, whether we're going to go to Crime Fest this year in Bristol.
Oh, I thought we said we...
Probably not.
Not paying, anyway. Well, we might make an appearance.
We make an appearance in the environs of Crime Fest. But, you know, it is incredibly expensive this year at over £200. In fact, 240, I think it was, even at the cheaper rate. Now it's the more expensive rate, so goodness knows what that is.
And being brutal about it, there's two of us. That's £500 just for the ticket.
Yeah, let alone the staying somewhere. Yeah. So we think it's probably not worth
it. I'd rather spend that on the company.
Yeah, there's other things that need to take priority, to be perfectly honest. And so that's what we're thinking. And same with London Book Fair. If you know, again... it's an environment, as we said last week, which is not necessarily conducive to a company of our size and makeup at the moment. And besides, we're in the process of negotiating, you know, third-party representation for a range of the aspects of London Book Fair that, you know, we have no expertise in or the contacts to make work. So it's, again, you know, it's one of those things which I might pop down for a day just to, you know, double check there's nothing of great value. I mean, there are opportunities to talk to some potential suppliers at these
which
things.
Which we did last year,
we
didn't
did, we? Yeah, to some extent. But, we're pretty happy with the offer, you know, the opportunities and things we've got so far. So don't think we need to worry about that for now. But, I think, you know, we're concentrating on consolidating and pushing the business forward. Don't necessarily need to go to the expense of going places for these sort of things.
No, and the fact that we can pop down to Bristol for the day and still see the people we want to see.
Yeah.
Not because we don't normally have time to attend the panels anyway.
No, we don't.
We'd like to, but quite often we'd rather just mingle, you know.
Yeah, the mingling's the bit that works for us.
There's nothing wrong with the panels at all. They're fantastic. It's just there's not enough time to do everything that you want to do.
No, indeed. Okay, well, I think that wraps us up for this week. Let's go just remind you, of course, to look at our website, which is www.hobeck.net. I think I'll write a new blog this week. I don't know what on. Oh, and the other thing we didn't mention in the news was our very exciting news, which we released yesterday in a newsletter form, which was that we are going to be publishing books, well, at least we did claim this yesterday, which was April the 1st, edible paperbacks.
I would like to say, so, and I did tweet about this today, but you know how when you have subscribers to a website, you can look at the statistics on how many people click the email, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, 11 people clicked my pre-order now link out of 6,000 subscribers. 11 people actually clicked the link to see.
And what happens when you click that link?
It takes you to a secret page on our website.
That says?
April Fool.
Yeah. It was very well done. Well, I sort of had the initial kernel of an idea.
Yeah.
And then you did a brilliant job. It was very convincing.
Such fun, though.
And actually, I think one of the best April Fools around. I mean, I think it's up there with turning the BT Tower in London into a wind turbine, along with Blackpool Tower and various other towers around the country. I think it's up there at that level, because there were some really bad ones, like Ant and Dec being considered to become the new Bonds. I mean, pathetic, pathetic, really poor, not unimaginative.
Well, it made me laugh, though.
Yeah, but I mean, it's so tired, isn't it? Anyway, let's wrap it up. So that's our website. And of course, please consider subscribing to this podcast if you're joining us for the first time. We do it every week. We talk to fantastic authors and members of the publishing community. We reflect on our weird and wonderful lives as Hobeck Books and as a couple of weird people.
I have one last thing to say. Yes. I just need to squeeze this in. So one of our books is actually only 99p 99 cents on ebook for this week only,
and fabulous. That
is Crossfire by R.D. Nixon, which is a fantastic crime series. There's three books in the series set in the Highlands of Scotland. I love it, absolutely love it. And so if you haven't read it yet, get your copy now, because it's only a third of a cup of coffee.
Absolutely, yeah, that's true. 99p is a third of a cup of words.
Especially on the M6.
Yeah, and the rest. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been Adrian Hobart.
I've been Rebecca Collins.
And you've been wonderful, as usual, all of you. So we wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.